Nier talks about the organized efforts that people may suspect but really can't imagine how deeply they go on the internet and on the news and pretty much everywhere you look. Nonprofits are used, PR firms are used, you know, everywhere you look. The images presented to you every day are often directed by special interests, political interests, paid, coordinated people, and this kind of traces that effort in a way that people have probably never seen. I mean, you may know not to believe everything on social media, but you may not know the software that's created that corporations and even the government uses to maintain fake Twitter accounts under the identities of different people with unique IP addresses, people that don't exist, and IP addresses that are coming from the same place but look like they're coming from somewhere else, to start movements and to influence opinion and to bully people who have the wrong opinion or controversialize people or start a narrative and perpetuate a narrative.
With me today is distinguished investigative journalist and author Cheryl Atkisson. Cheryl, welcome. Cheryl has her syndicated television show, Sunday Morning Show, The Full Measure, which can be viewed on ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, and Telemundo. Cheryl, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You've been a great supporter of OPSEC. We had done an earlier show, well before the election, on the Fourth Estate. And as things started to spiral out of control with all the fake news and the slanted media, I thought that we would go and revisit the Fourth Estate again with somebody of your stature and as an investigative journalist and a TV commentator. And I, you know, Cheryl is the author of the book Stonewalled and now soon to be released, The Smear, which will be out very soon, I guess, right, Cheryl?
Yep, that'll be out May 2nd. It's available for pre-order.
And I encourage you to go to Cheryl's website or give us your publisher's website, Cheryl.
My website's CherylAtkisson.com and fullmeasure.news, and the publisher's HarperCollins. You can order it, though, on Amazon or anywhere under The Smear.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading it. I enjoyed Stonewalled. I was aware, of course, from our discussions of your personal plight with and now we have the whole hacking thing with the Russians and the Democratic Party and the WikiLeaks and everything else. But this has been such a crazy year for, I don't know who coined the term fake news. I think that came out after the Brian Williams incident. The phenomena itself is nothing new, but it's just gotten out of control with this campaign season.
Well, I've traced it, and I go over this in my book, to about mid-September of 2016. Yes, fake news has always existed, depending on how you define it, always. But the movement to put it on the front page and on every newscast and to focus on it, particularly as an assault or crackdown on conservative news or even news that some people don't like, that is a recent phenomenon. I think that's a narrative and a propaganda effort that's been quite successful in the last couple of months.
It was successful, not as successful as some on the left had anticipated it to be, but, you know, it's of particular interest to me as a Green Beret and special operator. I had secondary occupational specialties in civil affairs and psyops or psychological operations, which is a huge influencer. We call it by a different name now. It's called information operations, but it's the same thing. It's influencing opinion. You know, it's a different form of advertising. It's much more subtle and insidious. And, you know, when it's contrived to paint a picture, particularly when the information is false, it borders on the criminal. You know, in when you're living in a country such as the United States, Western democracy, the fact that mainstream media again has lost its journalistic way and has gotten into this, we'll just call it propaganda because that's what it is. It's creating a false narrative with a specific agenda of electing their candidate.
Well, you know, I really think that this stems back from the blending and blurring between news organizations, corporations, political interests, special interests. This has been going on for some time, and this is really the only predictable outcome would be that the tactics used by government and corporations and PR firms to influence and sway us over the years would be spread through the news. I think that's exactly what's happened, and online. And we've been subjected to it in ways, I think people have a sense of it, but don't know, as you say, how insidious it is and how pervasive it is, especially online, which I do discuss in the book. I think they'd be surprised. But I kind of trace back the roots to CIA, World War II, the use of these tactics to sway public opinion and make us think a certain way that are now commonly used, I think, within the news and on the internet, but they have their roots going back many, many decades.
Sure, back to the days of the OSS in the Second World War, and we, as the United States, have used it quite successfully, but outside of our own borders, not to influence the opinions of fellow Americans. And one would think that the American public would be outraged, but I haven't seen that outrage, except for a select few.
I mean, if you pay hyper attention to things, again, you have a sense of this, but I think people don't understand how pervasive it is. And also, if they agree with some of the views that are being promulgated, they're really not going to fuss over it so much. So I think there's a mix of, as the government has taken part in these efforts, if you agree with what the government's doing, it doesn't bother you to see this plastered on the news. I think it bothers people who disagree. So we're very polarized right now, but there's not a general consensus to see propaganda efforts inside this country and propaganda efforts on the news as bad, because many people agree with what they're seeing and they don't understand taking a step back, looking at not just the issue, but the big picture is to news being used and internet being used for propaganda in surreptitious ways is a dangerous thing, because someday it's not going to be something you agree with or something that's true. And I think that's the danger that I see.
And it requires some personal research, you know, with the blogs now, or the fifth estate, I guess, as we move into the technology enhanced 21st century. Just because it's on the internet doesn't mean that it's true, whether it comes from the left or the right. In fact, we just witnessed this whole, the retribution of the pizza shop sex scandal thing. Apparently, and it was entirely fabricated. You know, I'm a firm believer in where there's smoke, there's fire, but just because it appears on the internet doesn't mean that it's true, and unless you can verify conclusively with multiple sources, it shouldn't be published. And I'm not talking necessarily about sharing something on Facebook, although that's a problem, but when you have the standing of supposedly journalistic integrity, then that's a real issue. And like anything, follow the money. You know, and see where it goes back and who's financing it and what the true motives are behind the underlying message.
I'm not sure. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not sure any news organization covered Pizzagate until and unless they covered it to say that it wasn't true. I don't think that picked up any traction. I mean, there is so much. It's almost like the National Enquirer. There is so much online that I think people know to take with a grain of salt. And my problem with censoring that stuff on social media or the stuff that's cycled around is once we allow self-appointed third parties that are supposedly independent, but in my view are not necessarily independent, once we invite them to discern facts for us, I'm afraid they're going to get in there and discern things that really are matters of opinion they don't like or facts that may be true that conventional wisdom says are not true today, but would be exposed as true tomorrow, like cigarettes causing cancer, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I'm very uncomfortable with the notion of
third party stepping in and censoring or determining truth. And I argue Facebook has a perfect right to do what it's doing, and Twitter to censor and stop certain stories. But I think that should be an opt-in. I think if you want them and trust them to censor your news or cull through it or determine truth for you, you should be able to check a box and say that's what you want. But I think you should be able to, just from a customer perspective, say that's not what I want. And as a journalist, I will say, I don't report stuff I find on the internet, but I find underreported angles, tips, sources, and contacts by looking at some of these places on the internet that people don't want me to see, that government doesn't necessarily want me to see or corporations don't want me to see. That's where I find leads to some of the things that I report on.
Sure. And it's a thin line. I mean, you know, I spent the greater part of my adult life defending our freedoms, and I certainly don't want to have my news censored because then it's not news anymore. And I do. I dig on my own. People send me things that I'm just not going to pass on because I doubt the veracity behind what I'm sent, even though it may fit a conservative agenda. Doesn't matter, you know, if you're deliberately spreading falsehoods and rumors and innuendo, it's wrong is wrong, regardless of what side it's on or what position it supports. And, you know, I hate to see people victimized by that.
Yep, that's true.
And, you know, you yourself were victimized, as was James Rosen, and probably a bunch of other journalists that didn't fit the agenda of the administration or values of conservatism. And that's frightening.
You know, you're talking about the infiltration of my personal and work computers by infiltrators that used software proprietary to a federal government agency. And my lawsuit against the federal government is working its way through court slowly. The Department of Justice isn't cooperating. They're trying to dismiss it. They didn't show up. Some key people, when motion for deposition, just didn't show up, didn't file a motion.
Imagine
didn't come.
That.
So, you know, it's very tedious. You would think if they want to claim no involvement, they would cooperate and help us get to the bottom of the forensic evidence that we have that shows a government computer connecting into my computer unauthorized, but instead they're just sort of putting up roadblocks. But, you know, back to fake news, I mean, my story wouldn't have been reported perhaps under third-party censors controlled by government special interests. They would say, gee, that wasn't true what happened, so we're not going to let the story get around. I mean, there's all kinds of perils I see with inviting people in to decide what truth is and what truth isn't. And as you may know, I was subjected to a very organized campaign to try to deflect from what had happened by, you know, Media Matters, David Brock, that's Hillary Clinton's, one of her operatives, and all the usual suspects, whether it's the online Vox and Salon.com, you can see them circulate the similar narratives for one another and try to controversialize reporters who don't report the right thing or discredit things that they disagree with. And the only way to fight back against that is with truth and with other outlets that will report the facts. When you say you do your research, I think that's great. I just think most people don't have the time to do their own research, and that's the role the news used to fill. You could kind of count on them to have done a little more research, but too often now we're just repeating the narrative that the government puts out as if it's the truth.
It goes beyond just the news agencies themselves, but government itself has called into question their own credibility when you have Michael Morell of the CIA writing talking points for the White House, going back to the Benghazi incident.
Well, and Mike Morell, I might point out, falsely telling senators that he didn't know who wrote the talking points initially, giving all kinds of incorrect testimony later, only when caught by emails admitting to what happened, and then being hired by CBS News as an analyst without the disclosure when he speaks that he, in essence, was working for a Hillary Clinton PR firm at the time.
Yeah,
and then
global.
Having him being quoted during the campaign as if he's some sort of independent former CIA official. These are all, you know, I think, propaganda efforts.
Now, that guy's a worm. And in fact, just last night, I talked to one of my associates two nights ago. He was hated, universally hated, when he was at the agency. He was an analyst guy. He did not come from a field operations background, but he was hated because of his duplicity and his pettiness. But
well,
no surprise.
You know, it was never explained during Benghazi why, even though he was the number two at the agency, why he took a front seat and Petraeus took a back seat to him on the tax that they were going to take and the talking points they were going to put out. No one ever explained how he got to be in the front seat on that. And then, if you'll notice, he took the side in his talking points of the State Department against the CIA. So this is my read of it. He sided against his own agency in defending Hillary Clinton's State Department and their actions when crafting those false talking points. And I think that it doesn't surprise me that he might have been disliked within his own agency.
Yeah, no surprise there. He's a self-serving opportunist, and his actions, if lying to Congress isn't a felony, and I believe it is, but he was never called out on that under this administration. And then, so no wonder people doubt that the Russians hacked emails or influenced the election, because what credibility do the intelligence agencies have?
You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. Well, it's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. You'll find a whole host of shows and a lineup of great content back at AmericaOutLoud.com.
Yeah, let me mention James Clapper, testifying under oath, the Director of National Intelligence, mm-hmm. falsely telling Congress that when asked a point-blank question by Senator Ron Wyden, was the U.S. government spying on tens of millions of Americans? And they were. We didn't know it at the time because Edward Snowden's information hadn't come out yet. But Clapper said no, and then later kind of apologized and did a mea culpa. But again, this does lend to understandable skepticism when the government declares things. It may be true, it may not be true. It's hard to know, and you certainly can't accept, I can't accept everything they say at face value without some investigation and sourcing for these very reasons. But I think the media, not just on this topic, but in the past 5 to 7 years, I've seen this incredible turn whereby we wait for the government to tell us something's true, and then we report it, or we hear what they say, and without our own skepticism and investigation, we report it. And that's not how it's supposed to be, ever, in my view. One perfect example of this is I've seen the media wait, even after the San Bernardino shooting, when that was obvious suspected terrorism, the media wouldn't even say suspected terrorism until the government gave the green light, I think, 4 days later to say something like that. And I argued, we don't have to wait for the government to codify a term or a word or tell the media what's okay to say. You can use your own research and your own reporting. And too often the media just says, well, the government says this, government says it's not terrorism yet. And, I'm just kind of appalled by that development. And at CBS, my last couple of years there, I would be told when I was investigating a story, well, let's wait and hear what the government says on X or Y, on things in which the government had a vested interest to not tell the truth, in my view. And I was just really surprised by that idea that's what we ought to be reporting. That makes you very much like state television, in my view, not an independent news organization.
Well, it's another page right out of Saul Alinsky's book, Rules for Radicals. They've totally infiltrated the media. When the president of CBS, I think I've got my stations right, is the brother of the deputy national security advisor, who was a failed fiction novelist. However, he got that position is beyond me. But, and all the intermarryings between West Wing personnel and mainstream media certainly is not coincidental.
I think it's more than that, too. A lot of people point to those examples, but I really think we've hired ideologues and brought them into the newsroom, whether it's Mike Morrell or reporters who used to be politicos. There's no line anymore, a firewall between the opinion people and the news people. And we saw in this last election, opinions by reporters were actually encouraged by the bosses in a way I've never seen before. And news outlets were emboldened to take positions on things in a way that they had never done before. I think that just made all bets off. I've just never seen anything like it, but it made the media turn into something, you know, it was already sliding toward anyway, but it's more of an advocacy or political organization than a news organization, and they admitted it. I mean, many news outlets mm-hmm. said this is the first time, for example, USA Today, this is the first time they said we've ever decided to not to unendorse a candidate is basically what they did. Don't vote for Trump. He's so dangerous. You know, don't possibly and under any circumstances vote for him. This was all unprecedented. And it was sort of like there was safety in numbers. Once the New York Times and, you know, big organizations like that that we tend to follow got on board with furthering narratives and being very open about it, it kind of seemed to give the green light for everybody to do it.
Sure, they encouraged one another.
I still think there's people out there, and maybe your listeners are among them, that would really like to be able to turn to independent news and not hear just what they want, but hear reporting that they can believe. If it goes after one side or the other, it's not because the reporter thought that or necessarily, or it's not because the news organization wanted it to be that way. It's just where the facts led. That's the beauty of doing independent reporting. And I get told now sometimes when I do a story that ends up targeting one side or the other, I get accused of ideology. And I don't blame people for thinking that, because so many reporters have demonstrated that's what they're all about. But what I used to love about the investigative reporting I do is I had a lot of people say, we know that when you do an investigation on, you know, Bush's bank bailout and it looks maybe bad for the administration, it's not because you are out to get President Bush, it's because that's where the facts led. Or we know that when you did the Fast and Furious investigation, you weren't out to get the Obama administration, the facts led to these, you know, damaging conclusions.
Well,
I think that's what people would like to get.
I think that there has always been an inherently adversarial relationship. Maybe adversarial is not the correct word, but between the media at large and any administration, the government outside of the three-branch system of government for checks and balances, we had the Fourth Estate. We had the media when it was once fair and impartial, to act as a check and balance against whatever administration was sitting at the time. I was a teenager through water. Yeah, there was a time where you'd listen to the news. You didn't know whether the newscaster was a Republican or a Democrat or left or right. You know, they reported the news as it was, as a story. And now there's such a thin line between a commentator, you know, again, going back to Chris Matthews, you know, he started as a journalist. I'm like, oh, no, wait. I said, you're putting yourself in a way different category. I said, I don't see you as a journalist at all, Chris. No offense, but
he was a Democrat, you know, Democrat staffer on the Hill as George Stephanopoulos worked for the Clintons and didn't disclose that as he did his political interviews. I like George, but I think every time he's on ABC, when he was doing campaign-related interviews, I think he had an obligation to disclose, if they would let him do those interviews at all, that he contributed to the Clinton Foundation and worked for the Clintons and their election. You know, this stuff isn't disclosed routinely. And
obligation. You don't leave that up to the viewers to decide for themselves or to, I mean, a lot of people knew Stephanopoulos' background, but he should have disclosed it.
Well, guess what? People today, I mean, you and I know that, but people under 30, they don't know that. I actually talk to younger people that have no idea some of these connections we kind of take for granted in the news and that are just sort of accepted. So I say disclosure is your friend. If you're a news organization, there's never any harm to disclosure. It can only help your credibility when you put that information out there for people. It doesn't mean what they're saying is less valuable, but it allows the viewer to weight what they're saying and understand where they may be coming from. That's something we owe them.
Well, and I, with the new administration coming in, all as we can ask is that the press treats them fairly. I have no such expectations, but I wouldn't want my news filtered from a Trump standpoint any more than I would from a Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton standpoint. And you get into a real dangerous precedent that creeps its way into perceived normalcy, and that's not to anybody's benefit.
Well, I don't think we can expect to see a fair shake given to Trump, the Trump administration. I think we will see any scandals uncovered quickly and thoroughly, because I think that's pretty much going to be on everybody's agenda. New York Times announced, I heard somewhere, its largest ever team assigned to cover the White House, and among them, two reporters who used to work for Politico who were revealed in the WikiLeaks emails to doing allegedly inappropriate things. Like, one of them called himself in an email a hack as he submitted a story for pre-approval by Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta. He's been hired by the New York Times to cover the Trump administration. The other one, Maggie Haberman, used to work for Politico. She was described by emails as a friendly to the Clinton campaign, mm-hmm. someone who they had used, they said, to tee up favorable stories in the past and that they could count on her. She's been assigned to cover the Trump administration, and I'm not sure how the New York Times thinks that those are assignments that have credibility with the public at large. I guess the people who want to read the New York Times, and they like exactly what those reporters will be writing. But there was a day when these types of things would have been scandals that excluded these reporters from not only covering the Trump administration, but from being reporters at the New York Times or anywhere else. But today it's not.
No, and it just seems like it's one thing after another. Then there's the Donna Brazile incident of as the DNC chairwoman or acting chairwoman to feed questions to a campaign from her network.
Well, and after she did that, she's now still served as an expert, again, with no disclaimers, on network shows that they turn to her for comments and opinion and truth. And she's been proven to be somebody who, in my opinion, gave false information when she was caught doing that about having done it, and also was, you know, doing something ethically questionable, not only in terms of the media, but in terms of that organization, how it was plotting against Bernie Sanders, although denied doing so on behalf of Hillary Clinton. So all of these things would have been, I think there would have been a time where those were disqualifiers to using someone like that as an expert on your program. But these days, I just think we're kind of buying into the narrative, and we're putting the PR people out there who want to be on TV or who the politicos want us to interview. And, you know, that's what we do.
We're facing a whole new paradigm in the 21st century now with social media. And I am by no means endorsing or a fan of Julian Assange or Edward Snowden. But in some ways, I got to say, thank God that there has been some light shed on exposing what the truth actually is, and exposing a lot of the lies and deliberate misinformation or disinformation that's been put out, not only by the media, but by the federal government, by the sitting administration.
Well, agreed. I mean, I think to some degree they have inadvertently filled the role that the media has left a gap in. You know, so these are stories that the media might have in another day uncovered or reported, but today these things, you know, they're less likely to be reported in the media. In fact, you remember when the Edward Snowden story came out, he had taken that information, I believe, to the Washington Post and maybe the New York Times. They didn't publish it until he took it to a British paper, and then they published it. And then suddenly, you know, the New York Times and Washington Post jumped in with some of their own coverage. But that would never have been published. That was my experience. I call it the soft censorship of, you know, self-censoring at news organizations, the things that we find out about that we don't report, that we keep off the front pages, that we would have reported during, you know, maybe 10 years ago. But again, my last couple of years in network news, I thought we were censoring or self-censoring a lot of stories of interest to the public that they would never know about.
Well, back in the Clinton administration, I was in England and I'm reading the newspaper and I'm like, wow, there's all these, they weren't allegations, but they were raising ties of the Clinton administration to all these mysterious deaths or murders. And I thought, this can't possibly be true. And the number back then was probably in the 20s. Now I think it may have climbed as high as the 40s. But and maybe this was before the internet, really. I'm not really positive on that. But I'm reading this a series of articles, and I'm like, I've never read anything in U.S. papers about that. And at the time, I followed the news, hard copy newspapers. I read them all as much as I could. And there was just way too much information that for it to have been a tablet, they were sourced. And, you know, years later, I guess, and mostly on the internet, you started to see more and more of it. But yeah, none of the newspapers in the United States, none of the major newspapers ever printed. I could never find anything related to that.
Here's the rub, and again, no allegations necessarily came with that story, but I believe if similar allegations had been made or facts had been exposed about other politicos that were not on the same side, that those would have been reported. My look at the media often involves the disparate treatment given to similar circumstances but by opposite parties. It either is news when one does it and then it's news if the other does it, or it's not news if either does it. But too often we report things one way when one side does it and not at all, or another way when the other side does it. And that's what I think is so wrong. We need to at least be consistent, give equal treatment to the different circumstances. Talking about foreign countries, this is also part of what I talk about in the book. This, the trend to sort of control the narrative of the media and to controversialize reporters who don't report the right thing or who report the wrong thing, that's happening now across the globe. And I met a bunch of reporters at an international conference in Russia last spring who complained of very similar things. Some of these reporters are on the right, some are on the left, some are in the middle, but they talk about the extraordinary propaganda campaign and powers and social media campaigns used to stop them if they're off narrative with whatever power is trying to control it, oftentimes government. And I think, again, this is a very bad development that's happening not just in the United States, but it's clear to me it's happening in many other places.
What, for the benefit of our listeners, Cheryl, and I want to tell everybody, as you await Cheryl's new book, The Smear, to be published, you have time now to go and read Stonewalled. If you could just kind of summarize the first book and your personal experiences for having operated in special operations, primarily human intelligence, but it's integrated with signals intelligence and basically being able to read other people's mail. And I'm not talking about opening their letters. I'm talking about compromising their cell phones, Blackberries, laptops. And you had firsthand experience. You had mentioned it, but give the listeners a little bit of background behind Stonewalled, and then we'll move into your sequel book yet to be published.
The Stonewalled book kind of begins with me covering a lot of these controversies under the Obama administration, similar to, you know, controversies I covered under other administrations, but really being stopped in a way under Obama that I had not been stopped before at CBS News. And me being told by a couple of different sources, before the Edward Snowden story, before we knew the government had spied on Associated Press, I've been told by a couple of sources, CIA, FBI related, that the government was likely spying on me or monitoring me. And it just sounded wild at the time because it had never occurred to me. But through my contacts, I let someone who has information about government software examine one of my computers. And another acquaintance of mine examined my house. And we found forensic evidence of intrusion. I reported it to CBS because this was always treated like it would be a huge thing if anyone ever got into our corporate computers, and somebody had. But, you know, sort of a strange reaction from CBS. They ultimately hired their own forensics expert who also identified intrusions of my work at home computers. And then I hired my own private expert in forensics who became the third person to confirm it, because I was just trying to depart from CBS at the time, and this was complicating a lot of things. But it turned out we were able to pinpoint the time some of the malware was planted by the intruders, that they had keystroke program monitoring my keystrokes. They had my passwords to all my private accounts. They had infiltrated the CBS system, in not just my personal computer. They had looked at my documents involving Fast and Furious, we could tell. And they had planted classified documents on my computer. And that's a presumption on my part. Classified documents were found on my computer that I didn't put there. So it's, excuse me. So my presumption, and the presumption of the forensics person who found this, was that the intruder had planted classified documents on the computer. I don't know what the purpose was, but I assume it's so that they could, this was during the government, you know, advent of their war on whistleblowers, so that it could either try to prove someone had provided them improperly or justify possibly a legal wiretap of some sort. So that's how that all started.
Talk about feeling violated.
Yeah, I mean, really, it was just when I found out that that really happened, I think the forensics expert who looked at it for me, they were all as surprised as I was. These are people connected to the government, and they said there was a time when this would never have been done. You know, the reporters were really off limits to this sort of thing, but they said that increasingly this administration was specifically targeting reporters. And, you know, I was just very, very intrigued by it, and I've wanted to get to the bottom of it. I've got a lot of information about it. I just don't know the ultimate... I have from a source of mine a name of someone who spearheaded this effort within the government, but I don't have forensic proof as to what computer it came from or who, you know, who ultimately organized the operation or authorized the operation.
Well, it was really sloppy tradecraft that left prints that even allowed it to be traced back.
Well, for your people who might be interested in this, I'm told, well, first of all, I would never have had this looked at on my own or even suspected. So this would never have been discovered if I hadn't had people inside the government warn me that this might be going on. So I don't think they really had to be that careful. But secondly, there were efforts to erase their tracks, but I'm told that the efforts to erase their tracks leaves its own record, and that's part of how we were able to get some information. We were also able to get bits of information from the hibernation mode of the computer, which doesn't erase things that other people tried to erase. That's how we found a government computer connected actively into my computer. That's very good forensic evidence for us. But I think that I was also told that if they didn't know where to look, they wouldn't have found it. In other words, this would have had to be somebody with experience and information to know how to find it. My computers had been looked at previously by CBS's experts, and nothing had been found. But once we knew kind of where to look, because we'd been keyed to it by the experts who knew, the material was easier for us to see. So I'm not sure. Yes, they may have been sloppy, but I'm not sure they were as sloppy as it seems, or that we would have ever been able to find this without help from somebody kind of on the inside.
Yeah, it takes a thief.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and that's in violation of so many federal laws. I know from just even when we're training for these things, there are so many disclosures under penalty of God knows what, you know, that you give consent. And but yeah, without the correct legal authorities and framework in place, that's a tremendous violation of law, especially involving U.S. citizens.
I don't know all of the ins and outs in my circumstances, but again, I've had government sources who've offered to help me any way they can. And some of them have told me there's ways to get around this sort of thing, for example. And I'm not saying this is what happened. This is just what a high-ranking intel official made me aware of. The president can issue a presidential directive that can allow for something that would normally be illegal to happen. And then he can even, in that directive, make sure these come with cover stories in the event the operation is disclosed or found out about, and those involved have automatic indemnity from prosecution. So there's ways to get around the idea that some of this would have been very, very illegal, and who knows what they did.
Wow.
So can you give us a little bit of a preview into the smear?
The smear talks about the organized efforts that people may suspect but really can't imagine how deeply they go. On the internet and on the news and pretty much everywhere you look, nonprofits are used, PR firms are used, you know, everywhere you look, the images presented to you every day are often directed by special interests, political interests, paid coordinated people, and this kind of traces that effort in a way that people have probably never seen. I mean, you may know not to believe everything on social media, but you may not know the software that's created that corporations and even the government uses to maintain fake Twitter accounts under the identities of different people with unique IP addresses, people that don't exist, and IP addresses that are coming from the same place but look like they're coming from somewhere else, to start movements and to influence opinion and to bully people who have the wrong opinion or controversialize people or start a narrative and perpetuate a narrative. This sort of thing is happening constantly. And then the news media and the quasi-news media, like these groups, Media Matters, Salon.com, Vox, again, there's a handful of maybe 10 to 15 of them that pick up the same narrative on one another's behalf. And then it works its way into Politico, The Hill, these more, slightly more newsy outlets that will pick up narratives and repeat them. And then pretty soon they're on, you know, the mainstream media or what people used to consider the trusted media. And these are how narratives are being accomplished and opinions are being swayed today. We saw a lot of this during the campaign. So I think people will be fascinated by this. And the goal is just to help, as someone who's kind of studied it and been subjected to it for a while, I feel like I recognize it almost, you know, at a glance. And you can get to be where you're like that, too. If you read this material and watch carefully, you'll start to recognize narratives and campaigns and I think maybe be a wiser consumer of information in this astroturf reality that we have.
Well, I encourage all of our OPSEC listeners to buy both your books and read them and become better informed and more astute in discerning the messages that you hear every day and peel back the onion a little bit. I know some of the organizations that you mentioned are funded with George Soros money. If you peel back the layers, Soros is behind a lot of that in his agenda. And, you know, this is where I say it's insidious because it's non-attributable, it's subtle, and it's false.
That's right. And, you know, I think that's happening not just with sort of quasi-news outlets, but also nonprofits and charitable groups that you listen to that you have no idea were started by an interest that maybe even seems opposing or contrary to the cause that it's promoting. These are surreptitious efforts, and your audience may be a little bit wiser, more wiser than most to these sorts of efforts, but I still think we can all learn something by examining things more closely. And I want to thank your listeners, the men and women in this field, for all that they do for our country, and say how much I really appreciate the work that all of you have done. And give my thanks to you guys.
Well, I know I personally am grateful, and I think I can speak on behalf of our listenership to those who have and have not served. We appreciate that gratitude and recognition, and certainly we want to extend our gratitude to you, Cheryl, for shedding some light on this. And I've always thought that you were a very impartial journalist through several administrations, and I would love to see the media in general get back to reporting the news based on fact and not their own political agendas.
Well, I try to look at things not from any sort of partisan view. I'm not a political person to begin with. Not that I don't have my own views. But I try to look at things from the consumer's viewpoint or the voter's viewpoint or the average American viewpoint, what they would wonder about, what they would want to know, and what their interests are. And that's how I try to see. That's what I see as my main interest.
Well, I think that the more that this comes to light, that hopefully people from both sides of the political spectrum, I mean, there would certainly be an outcry if the incoming administration tried to influence the media for their agenda. Not that I see that as a likely outcome, but you know, it doesn't matter which side it's on. It matters that it's happening, period. And that's something that everybody, regardless of one's own political leanings, should be concerned about for the preservation of democracy and freedom.
Agreed. I mean, we don't really want to have a news media where it's like North Korea. If you have a TV at all, you turn on the TV and it tells you how great it is in your country, even if you're starving, and how terrible it is everywhere else. And people know and don't believe what's on the news, but that's all they have. We don't want to be like that. And I see us headed down that road if we're not careful.
Well, the wake-up call, I think, came on Election Day or the day after, when after being told that this was a slam dunk for Hillary Clinton, just because you heard it on the news doesn't mean that it was true.
Word to the wise.
Cheryl, thank you so much for devoting your time and joining us today on OPSEC Radio. You're listening to us as part of the America Out Loud radio network. And please go to Cheryl's website, read Stonewalled first, and get your order in now for the smear. And you can continue right on as soon as it's published. Cheryl, thanks again.
Thank you so much. Touches on that book, every news event that happens fits into the topic I was writing about, so I kept adding and adding and adding, and then finally just had to turn it in.
I didn't realize, I'd seen on your email the little thing for the smear, and before you had sent the email back addressing it specifically, I looked it up. I'm like, oh my God, this is perfect.
Well, it's funny because I didn't call it, the fake news name hadn't been invented yet when I started writing the book, of course. But it's what the book is all about. So then I made the last chapter be post-election stuff that attacks, you know, the fake news phenomenon and all that stuff, or the supposed fake news phenomenon.
Well, you know, one of the irony is that, and the mainstream media just probably does not get it at all, but the irony is after the Clinton campaign and mainstream media buying into it and calling Trump and Trump supporters every, you know, beyond deplorable, but, you know, the racist, the misogynist, if you support Trump, you're a racist, xenophobe. I told this guy, I said, you know, I've been called a racist so many times that you just wore the word out. I mean, Chris Matthews called me a racist years ago because I didn't like Obama. And I said, the man's half white. I don't like that half of him either. How does that make me a racist? Because I don't get a tingle down my leg? I don't like his policies.
It's just a narrative, you know, that, and I tweeted on last night, I just sent out a tweet that said, a lot of people use the word racist when they mean prejudiced or, what's the other word I was, another word, like racist, as you know, means you believe another race solely on race is inferior. And, you know, saying that you don't believe in illegal immigration has nothing to do with A, race, or B, with superiority.
Right.
But there's other words that could be used. But like you say, if everybody's racist, nobody is. I mean, it doesn't help their cause to just call everybody racist for everything. It dilutes the word. And then really no one takes it seriously.
And I've asked people, I said, so, you know, if I'm a racist because, you know, I'm demanding that we secure our borders and enforce immigration laws, I said, if we had thousands of Canadians a day and maybe Norwegians and Swedes sneaking in, and, you know, would I be a racist still? Or is it just a Latino thing?
It's so logical to look at it that way, but it's just people just listen to this drivel. And I think half the people who hear it get mad. That's why Trump got elected. The other half are successfully polarized and believe it. So you end up with polarized America.
That's
what
I was getting at, with the irony being that all the disinformation and the labels calling not just Trump but any of his supporters racist and misogynist and homophobes. Nobody wants to be painted that way. So they became the silent majority. And MSM deceived itself into thinking that Hillary was going to win by a landslide. I didn't think so. I thought Trump was going to win, not by a landslide. I thought he just squeak it out because it's a movement and a lot of people don't want to be painted as a racist or a misogynist, so they just stay mute and they don't address it, but they go to the polls and they express themselves, and that's exactly what they did.
Well, I thought all along he might win and said so all along. I think he would have won by a much larger margin if not for all the false reporting and the smears. I think that did dig into him, but he had such big support it didn't dig in.
I agree with you totally. I think in spite of everything being set against him and having such unfair treatment, and for that matter, Bernie Sanders was treated very unfairly, not as much, but by the media and certainly by the Democratic Party.
Totally.
I'm not a big fan of Bernie Sanders or his policies, but, you know, what's fair is fair. But, you know, it gave me great pleasure, I have to admit, to see, you know, everybody, you know, even the Fox News. It doesn't matter what station you came from. Everybody was in total shock, all the pollsters. I stayed up on election night and admittedly reveled in the victory. It's time for a change of policies. And we certainly got it.